This is tape 4 of the afternoon of January the 27th. Well, Mr. President, the reason I had asked about style and writing and all that sort of thing is, as I said before, because history's always been conceived as literature. What do you conceive history to be?
History is a record of events as they took place. It's a record of the men who caused those events to take place. And when it's not arranged in a way so that people can understand the objective, then it's a waste of time to try to read it.
Well, then where does interpretation come in?
Interpretation comes after the facts have been set down in regard to the men who made history and into the happenings which took place in the historical period. Then the interpretation can come along by anyone who wants to take a hand and do that. And some people like to interpret things entirely out of context with what the facts state, and when the facts are well stated, they can't do that.
There's been an awful lot of romancing and an awful lot of padding and gilding the lily in our written history.
These historical novels, I think, add more to that than any other thing. Although they're interesting reading, and sometimes you want to go and look the facts up, you can get some good out of them.
Well, but the facts usually fall pretty much into place as time goes on, and the more retrospect you have in time distance, the more clearly you get the picture of
what
has happened.
That's true. That's absolutely true. It takes about 25 or 30 years to find out exactly what a man in an executive position has been able to do, because the results sometimes of his actions do not take place until sometime after he's gone.
Now, to get to a personal thing here quickly, if you can answer it, you've studied history all your life, and then you sort of made it. Not sort of, you made it. And looking at your impression of history before you became president and since your presidency, were there many things that had taken on different values after you began to look at history in terms of the presidency?
Oh, yes, naturally they would, because it's when you have to be in a responsible position, especially an executive position, you begin to understand some of the things with which men were faced who were in the same position before that time, and sometimes you may not have agreed with them. But after you have been in the position and understand what he's up against, then you look up maybe the facts on all sides of the matter, and you can change your mind on what he was doing. But it's fundamentally basic that history is made by men who have the welfare in our country, by men who have the welfare of the people in their minds, and they have to make decisions in order to get that done. Sometimes those decisions are not exactly what they ought to be, but a man who's willing to make the decision in the first place can always make another one to correct any mistake he's made.
Well, Mr. President, you made a very important statement there that as a result of your experience, you're able to look back at history or certain events and appraise them differently. You do amaze me by one statement that you do make, and that is that you say that we have had men, and you're talking now about presidents,
that's right,
who always had the welfare of the people in mind. Do you really believe that? Isn't that something of an American myth in your mind?
No, it isn't. I think the vast majority of the presidents were always as anxious as they could be to serve the people to the best of their ability. Some of them didn't know how to do it. That's what caused their trouble. Some of them did know how, some of them did a good job, some of them did a fair job, and some of them didn't do any job at all.
All right, then let me ask you this. Why is it that these presidents had that? Because that is a unique attitude of rulers or of men who govern against the background of history where a lot of governors or rulers didn't give a darn about the people.
Well, that's true in a great many instances, but you find that most of these chief executives in the states and in the nation were anxious to do the best they possibly could for the country, for the simple reason that most of them wanted to make a reputation for doing just that. Some of them were anxious to be re-elected and to fill the place again. That's the reason the 22nd Amendment is a bad amendment, because it puts an end to a man's ambition to go ahead with what he's trying to do. But in my opinion, and I made quite a study of it, the the vast majority of the presidents of the United States and the vast majority of the governors of the various states have tried the best they knew how to do what they thought was right for the people. Of course, their thoughts may not have been in line with what some other people may have thought. But you find by studying the thing that there was not a single president of the United States who was anyway in any form trying to debauch the government of the United States. He was trying to help and to go along with what the Constitution provides. Some of them had energy, some of them worked all the time, some of them didn't, and that made the difference. I still contend that every president of the United States, so far as I can find out, with very few exceptions, tried his best to do what he thought was best for the country.
Well, now you're making some exceptions. I think it would be well to name those exceptions for the record, if you could.
Yeah.
Because you're stating almost categorically that whatever mistakes there were mistakes of judgment, that there never any evil intent on the part of any chief executive.
I think that's correct. Now, there were some who didn't work very hard at the job, who really didn't understand the Constitution area, didn't understand their position as chief executive. And we've had examples of that immediately after the war between states. We had a general in charge who was a good-hearted, honest man, I think, and a great field commander. But as president of the United States, he was a complete failure. We've just had another example of that just recently under the same circumstances. And the same thing happened when Zachariah Taylor was made president of the United States. He didn't pay much attention to the executive powers with which he was given under the Constitution of the United States. And his successor was a little more ignorant on the subject than he was. But we'll go into those things in detail when we come to
what you're saying. In effect, though, even though these men were inadequate or incompetent in some of the cases
for their tasks,
the system was such that no permanent damage accrued to the country as a result of it.
No, and they were not intending to do damage to the structure. They just didn't know how to make it work. One of the greatest of the great presidents was a field general. His name was George Washington. He set up the government, and he knew how to make it run. Andrew Jackson was another one who was a field general and who knew how to make the government run and who was a chief executive in fact as well as in name. And we'll find at least six or seven presidents who had that same attitude. Then you'll find six or seven who were perfectly willing to just fill in and let the Congress run the government. If the Congress felt like it wanted to do it, and sometimes the Congress did and sometimes it didn't.
Well, Mr. President, are you suggesting the very unique thought that despite the long history of the world and governments everywhere, this is a government which had as its leaders men who were not out deliberately to wreck or debauch or destroy the government or to do anything contrary to the welfare of the people willfully?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. And you won't find that in inherited monarchies, where the chief executive inherits his job. You find some of those kings and princes and emperors were deliberately trying to increase their own power and their own welfare rather than the welfare of the people, and that's what caused, in some instances, revolutions. But that hasn't been true with the elected office of the presidency of the United States. Most states, and I'll say all those men who've been elected president of the United States were anxious and willing to do what they thought was right if they knew what it was. Some of them didn't know, that's all.
Isn't it also a fact that under other systems, military control, a control by military heroes or men of great military might, resulted in some kind of dictatorship, and yet we have never had even the suggestion of that kind of a thing here?
No, that's true. And that came from the overthrow of the Roman Republic, when the military leaders were in charge of the government of Rome. And when that finally subsided, and they had a half a dozen good emperors after this situation took place, those men were anxious to make the Roman Republic what it ought to be. You can name a half a dozen of the great emperors of Rome whose objective was the welfare of the Roman people. And even at that time, they called it the Roman Republic. And the same thing is true with our presence because they're all elected at a for a certain term and a certain period. And people don't like them, they know they can be thrown out. But I think the men have all been honorable men and wanted to do the right thing.
And you think they did want to do the honorable thing as much the desire for fame and reclaim as well as from duty?
Well, I don't like to charge presidents with trying to get themselves headlines and things of that kind. Oh, there have been some that wanted to do that, but I think most of them were anxious to do their duties.
Now, is there any special category or a special environment from which a chief executive is drawn?
Under our system, they've come from all walks of life. And most of them have been highly educated men, and men who are interested in the welfare of the government, in the welfare of the people that make up the government. And I will, sometime at a later date, try to set out an analysis of each man's background and what made him tick. And if we can do that, then we can find out that nearly every single one of them was anxious to do the right thing.
Would you, we're talking about categories, would you exclude any environment or function?
No, I wouldn't.
Not even the military?
I wouldn't exclude any of them, but I think the history has proven that a professional military man has difficulty in running a free government.
But in other words...
Because he's used to being a dictator in his life.
I get from all this philosophic point of view that in a certain sense the president represents almost the very civilization in which he lives and which has been transposed and developed in this country.
I think that's true. I think that's true. His background and education has a great deal to do with his attitude. And I think that you find that the vast majority of them want to do the right thing. Some of them didn't know how to do it. Some of them didn't care about doing it. Some of them want somebody else to take the responsibility. And we'll go into that as we come across them one at a time.
Well, and he can advocate any improvement or any change in whatever it is we're doing, but he cannot coerce or impose it on the country.
No. He's got to make the country believe that what he wants to do is the proper thing. That's the reason he's the greatest public relations man in the world.
Well, this has all been very interesting, Mr. President. This is the end of tape for the afternoon of January the 27th.
Hello there, is it all?
But
nothing more important.
This is the morning of January the 29th, the President, Noyes Hillman here. Mr. President, in this introduction, to the Harvard Guide to American History, there's a discussion about the different changes of interpretation in history. And this writer goes on to say, for instance, about a half century ago, the United States history from 1815 to the Civil War, as taught in the North and West, turned about slavery, and the Democrats were the villains in this drama. Whigs like Daniel Webster, who compromised with the, quote, slave power, unquote, were treated as renegades. Stephen A. Douglas was a rascal. The South, of course, never accepted this tradition, but not until a series of books by such men as Woodrow Wilson and Frederick J. Turner showed how many other important topics besides slavery had been discussed during the period and how vital the Compromise of 1850 was while preserving the Union, did school histories in the North break away from Uncle Tom's cabin. Before the process was complete, along came the Beards, who told us that the Compromise of 1850 involved a sordid and successful effort of Wall Street to unload Texas bonds. Economic determinists naturally seized upon this as the outstanding feature of the Compromise, snatching from the godlike Daniel's brow his recently recovered laurels. Now we have come a full circle. A younger historian has denounced the pussyfooting of his immediate predecessors on the slavery question and has even revived the use of that invidious old phrase, the slave power. Now, Mr. President, what's your feeling about these
Well, the situation is a very difficult one for the simple reason that the history of the period has been written from biased and vicious newspaper editorials and articles. And sometime or other, we're going to have a clear outline of what actually took place from 1809 until 1861. And we'll then have a better viewpoint of what really went before the abolition of slavery. Of course, if you remember, an effort was made to gradually eliminate the slave trade beginning in 1809. And it was not carried through. That was one of Jefferson's programs that he was very anxious to see carried through. And I'm sincerely hoping that we can get the facts arranged in the presidential administration between 1809 and 1861 in such a manner that the men who were in charge during that period will have a just appreciation of what they did and also an appreciation of what they didn't do. And we have no idea of writing a history that will in any way be a sensational affair. What we want to do is put the administrations of the various presidents in a viewpoint that the youngsters can understand and can appreciate what those men were trying to do. The repeal of the Compromise of 1815, the repeal of the Compromise of the Missouri Compromise, was really the direct cause of the war between the states.
Well, what you're trying to do is to distinguish or as between what was transient in our development and what was permanent, what really became part and parcel of our society, and to explain how we could become a democratic republic. Forgive me for using that term.
Well, that's what it is, the Democratic Republic.
Without risking running into a tyranny by majority. How we could have a set of standards of morality without having an established church by the state. All those things that seem to have been raised by people who were asking questions about our ability to survive. But mostly it is to separate out those things that you refer to in the newspapers as having been the product of the passions of the moment, and to get, from your point of view, as having been president, exactly what was really stable, permanent, and basic about how we came along.
That's true, and how what brought about the settlement and improvement of the resources west of the Mississippi, 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 resources west of the Mississippi. Adjunct to that settlement was the fact that the Homestead Act was passed so that a man could claim 160 acres of land, $1.25 an acre, which is supposed to cover the expenses of the survey. Well, then, when a man became the possessor of land and built himself a cabin or a house and was a permanent settler of the situation, all through the Middle West, that then stabilized the republic that we're talking about. When a man becomes an owner of a piece of property, no matter in what form it is, whether it's stocks and bonds or land or a house in town or anything of the kind, he then becomes an interested citizen in his the carrying on of his government. And that's the only time that he ever does. And that substantially prevents the mob rule that the men who wrote the Constitution were fighting against. They were one digital dictator, but we didn't have a mob rule for the government of the United States, and we haven't had. The United States, and we haven't had. It's a republic, and the reason for that, you're set up in a republic.
Did we start out with sense of participation in the class struggle that was beginning. The class struggle that was beginning to develop all over the world, the civilized world.
Oh, I think that's true, but I think there's too much emphasis put on the class struggle. Because you take an air fellow who was a poor man, had the same opportunity to rise, and riches, and the class struggle, so-called, is I think more conversation than action than what actually took place.
Let me put it to you another way, if I may. Bill's got a thing to read there, which is very... what is, in your opinion, the least important, story for our youngsters to get, and what is most important for them?
Well, the most important thing for the youngsters to attain is a complete understanding of the Constitution, the basic form of our government, and also to understand that the rights of the individual come first, because you notice in the preamble of the Constitution that those powers which are not delegated in the Constitution remain in the people. And that's his responsibility then becomes, as a citizen, a part of the government of the United States.
Well, what do you think is least important for us to put down as a basis for historic exposure?
Well, the least important things you can put down, and I've got a lecture on this topic, are the periods of hysteria which affected the country, and from the beginning with the programs and in the early 1800s, we had an anti-Masonic program, and we had an anti-Catholic program, and then that program, and then that program, and then that program, and then that wound up by having a Ku Klux organization that was anti-Negro, and before he got through, the Ku Klux of 1920 was anti-Catholic, anti-Negro, anti-Jew. And those things are caused by periods of hysteria. Some demagogue gets up and says that the Catholic Church is going to ruin the country, and some demagogue gets up and says the Masons are about to murder everybody that doesn't believe the way they do, and first thing you know, he's got a following. And there was an organization during the 1920s, the Brown Shirts, an old fellow down in North Carolina who didn't have any object in view but to raise money and fees that he had things to sell to the Brown Shirts, that's all.
Well, to go back to the beginning now, if you were just starting out to lecture a class of students on American history and you wanted to start at the beginning, what would be your beginning?
Well, the beginning would be the settlement of the colonies and their attitude toward self-government. I think that's one of the most important things that took place. You see, the colonies along the East Coast were made up of several different sections from Europe. There were the English in Massachusetts, there were the Dutch in New York, the Swedes in Delaware and New Jersey, the Catholics from Britain in Maryland, and then the next British colony was Virginia. And North Carolina and South Carolina and Georgia were settled by various sections of the population of Europe. Now, Georgia was a debtors' state. The debtors came to Georgia under the man who was responsible for settling Georgia. And in South Carolina, the Huguenots came from France. All those then, in the colonial setup, when the Continental Congress was organized, had viewpoints which finally were put together and made, I think, the greatest document governing the Constitution of the United States.
Well, then you would cut short all those preliminaries having to do with the beginnings of searching out the new land, the movement this way, and the discovery of America. You wouldn't belabor those at all?
Well, I would be sure that the people, the youngsters, understood the necessity for that thing to happen. But the important thing, I think, for them to understand is the organization of the colonies as self-governing bodies, which finally wound up in the United States of America.
You think that is the
most important thing? That's the most important thing in the whole thing.
Don't you think that you have to call our attention at the beginning to something of what was Europe at the time that this thing began to at the time that colonies were established?
Yes, no question about that.
After all, I keep coming back to the fact that perhaps the most important thing about the separation of church and state in this country grew out of the fact that there was already this Protestant movement.
The Reformation.
And the Reformation.
And of course, Henry VIII gets some credit for it. And the principal reason he gets the credit is because he won the Bury six times.
Well, Henry VIII, of course, got involved with Columbus's brother, didn't he? But that was the seventh time.
That was the seventh.
Now, in your opinion, then, we go over lightly and quickly the beginnings, not to overtax the student.
To get to the important thing, which is the Constitutional Convention that set up the government of the United States, one of the contributing causes of government, by the government and how it came to be, as far as we need to go.
The on the right into the heart of the colonies into a union, and the organization of the colonies into a union, and then the Constitutional Convention.
Constitutional Convention, and the presidential, say the policies of each president from Washington all the way to the Civil War, and then we'll take a new start.
Well, then you want to get away from the steps that brought us to the state of a nation, and get right on with the kind of a nation we are and what we did after we became a nation?
Yes, that's the most important thing. It's why we were stabilized as a nation, I think, is the most important thing.
I'm sorry.
Let's end this tape on January 29th.